In Vancouver, I am Plant on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. Marina Nemat joins me now. Her previous book, Prisoner of Tehran, was a critical hit and bestseller around the world. It told the story of her life. How at the age of 16, she was arrested by Iranian Revolutionary Guards, tortured, and sentenced to death. Now, in a new book, After Tehran, A Life Reclaimed, she talks about her escape to Canada and how she confronted her past and how she managed to deal with the pain of memory. It's a remarkable story. She lives in Toronto with her husband and two children, but she joins me here in Vancouver. The book is published by Viking. Her website is at marinanemat.com. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Marina Nemat. Good morning, Ms. Nemat.
Thank you so much for having me, Joe.
You're very welcome. Did the success of the previous book and the reception that it got, did that surprise you?
It did. When I wrote Prisoner of Tehran, for me, you know, the best way I can explain it is that, you know, for so many years after I left Iran, came to Canada, I pretended to be a normal person. When something so difficult happens to you, you usually run in the opposite direction, and so does everybody else. Nobody wants to face it. But these events, your past, it's almost like an elastic band, and you run and run and run, but it pulls you in. And one day you just can't resist the pressure anymore, and it pulls you right in. So it's almost like hitting the wall. So that was when Prisoner of Tehran happened. When I hit the wall, I either had to go jump off a bridge or do something a little bit more positive with it, and it was writing. I never thought about how the book would be received. The point was to put everything on paper. And once everything was on paper, my plan was to start writing fiction because I enjoy writing and I enjoy the freedom that fiction offers you. But then as I traveled to promote Prisoner of Tehran, every single journalist around the world, everywhere, they asked me, why did you wait 20 years to write your first book, you know, to tell the world what happened? And I wanted to bang my head against the wall. You know, it is so strange that when you have lived, you know, in the West, a normal life with relative freedom and all of that, you take everything for granted. And you really think that a girl comes out of prison at the age of 18 after 2 years of torture and rape and a lot of other horrible things, and she can just sit down and be poetic about it. It is a very long process.
Did you always write as a child? Did you write?
I did. I wrote a lot of little poems, you know, childish little poems. And I wrote a lot of essays for school because we had a subject, you know, this lesson. So it was called composition. And we basically would be given a topic, and then we would have to write about that. And I was always very good at it. And I remember I had a teacher, I think it was in either grade 7 or 8, and she told me that one day you will become a writer. And I laughed. I just laughed my head off because even though I enjoyed writing, I never thought of myself as a writer.
And you found great comfort in writing, didn't you?
You know, I always enjoyed writing. There is something about writing that really takes me away from everything else. The problem with nonfiction writing is that it almost has the opposite effect. It takes you right in. But where I was at my life, I couldn't go on unless I confronted the past. You become a prisoner of those events. They let you go. You go home from prison. Nobody talks about it. Everybody ignores you. You ignore yourself. And you become a prisoner of that. So writing nonfiction for me was a way to free myself from that situation.
Do you think that your writing, these two books and you're writing about your life, has that put a burden, say, on your children or your husband?
At the beginning, I guess you could say that, because nobody knew what to make of it. It was like I was pushing them and pushing myself, to be honest, into a territory none of us knew. Nobody knew what to expect. Nobody knew what would happen. So it was very scary, really, for me, for my husband, for my children. But as time went by, they saw saw how I became happier is not the right word, but almost like I became myself. Before
free.
That, yeah, I was a shadow. I was, I always gave very brief answers to every question. I never talked much. I was really a shadow of myself. These saw how I came to life, after the first book was published. And gradually they saw that the world, even though there were negative responses to the book, very negative personal attacks, but in general, they saw that the world really embraced the story and did appreciate it, and that altogether as a family, we became much closer to each other, and there was a lot of honesty there. There were no lies anymore. There was no cover-up.
You just mentioned the negative responses to the book.
Mm-hmm.
What was the criticism, that it wasn't accurate?
All sorts of things. When you write nonfiction, especially about a topic that could be considered political. Now, my memoir, is not a book about politics at all. It is the story of a young girl, the first one, the story of a young girl who was just thrown into this madness, into this crazy situation. It is about that. It is the human experience. It is not about ideology and it is not about religion. It is just about me and what happened to me and my friends. In relation to what happened to me, I'm talking also about my friends who suffered greatly. As a result, especially when a whole regime, the Islamic government of Iran, it has tried to cover up the massacre and murder and torture of its young generation for 30 years. They have denied it. They have denied that they have ever done it. So they were naturally very upset when the book came out. And so there were a lot of personal attacks online, obviously coming from people who said, but it never happened. Nobody, in a way personally against me, but in general saying we never tortured anybody, you're lying. Young people were never arrested and hurt in Iran's prisons, which was ridiculous. I had expected that part. But there was also a very small group, maybe about 30 people, of very ideological individuals who had been in prison at the same time. But I was 16 when I was in prison. Let's say they were between 25 and 30 or maybe even 35. And 90% of us in prison were under the age of 18. So these people were a minority. They actually believed in something. We were there because we had protested here and there. We were not, at 16, how political can you get?
Yeah.
But these people actually believed in something. They stood up for something. Some of them broke under torture, some of them didn't. With the young people, the majority of us, not all of us, but the majority of us, we did break under torture, and I was one of those people who broke. And we were blamed by this group of people who actually believed in their ideology of fighting the Islamic Republic to the death. And they looked at us as traitors. And basically we were almost being attacked, from left and right. We had to face our interrogators. And at the same time, we had to face these people. But they were a minority. This was not such a huge problem in the prison. And I had almost, put it aside. I never thought that these people would still be living in the same frame of mind. But they were. So they attacked me. They said, how dare you talk about, for example, in my first book, I tell the story of the interrogator who forced me to marry him. And his family were kind, normal people. They were really kind to me. They basically helped me get out of the prison. And he was assassinated by a rival faction of the government. And he had been a political prisoner during the time of the Shah. So, I portrayed him as the person that I knew, as a man who was conflicted, who had one day been a victim, but now he was a torturer. And I couldn't figure out why was he the way he was. And I have told the story very honestly. I haven't portrayed him as an entirely evil person. And this upset a lot of people. They said, how dare you? How dare you say that a torturer had humanity in him?
Yeah. Now, this book, After Tehran, tells a story about after leaving Iran, right?
Yes.
Well, when did you come to Canada?
We came to Canada in 1991.
And did your parents follow after that?
About a year, a little bit more than a year, about 14 months later, yes. My fear was when I left Iran, well, of course, at the beginning, it was all about leaving Iran. Like, it was so important because I had that sentence still hanging over my head, and I could have been arrested at any moment. I had, after I was released from prison, I broke some Iranian laws again, so I could have been arrested. So the important thing was to get out. Once we got out, and it took 10 months to get to Canada. Once we got to Canada, one of my first priorities was to get my parents out of Iran, because I was always worried that if I don't go back and they realize I'm missing, they would get my parents. I was always afraid of that. So the important thing was to get my parents out, and we managed to do that. They got out, they got here, and then they lived with me.
Why Canada? I guess you had a brother here, right?
Yeah, I had a brother here. You know, the world is a big place. You know, if they had told me South Pole, I would have gone.
Yeah.
If they had told me North Pole, I would have gone. But when there was a choice, it's natural, very natural that you would go where you have family. And, of course, my brother was very happy in Canada, which helped.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How do you identify yourself? Do you identify yourself as Canadian, or are you also Iranian?
I find this an interesting question. You know, I was born in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot just throw it out the window. It is not something to discard. You cannot change the fact that you were born at a certain place on planet Earth. You know, I wasn't born on an Earth airplane over international waters.
Yeah.
And I wasn't born in Canada. So I can't change that. I'm a very proud Canadian. My Canadian passport is one of my most valuable possessions. You know, I am proud of that. I'm proud to say, wherever I'm in the world, I'm proud to say I'm Canadian. And the way I'm always introduced is Canadian-Iranian or Iranian-Canadian. I don't know. I don't even know how to put it. But the truth is that I was born in Iran, and Iranian culture, which is a beautiful culture. It is a culture of beauty and poetry and literature and dance and music, 2,500 years of it. Well, the last 30 years, you know, things have been terribly wrong. But before that, we have a lot of culture in us. And that is a part of it. That was, I also have some Russian background. And so in a way, maybe I should say I'm Russian, Iranian, Canadian.
Yeah.
Because these are all, you know, when I hear Russian on the street, I melt. Because it just touches my heart. I find it musical. I find it beautiful. And you know, Russian cuisine, you know, I'm in love with it, the same with Persian. So these are all parts of our identity. You know, I don't know how can a person just discard a part of who they are. To me, that's just impossible.
When you came to Canada, you worked at McDonald's and Swiss Chalet, right?
Mm-hmm, yes.
There's a story in the book about Ed, who was one of your customers at the Swiss Chalet. Can you tell that story?
You know, it was, when you work in a restaurant, a lot of interesting things happen to you. And you meet a lot of people, and some of the situation you face seem harmless at first, but then they can turn very interesting. One day at a restaurant, a man came in, and I worked the lunch shift, so I seated him at a table by the window, and I did everything I normally do. You know, I gave him the menu. I asked him if he wanted something to drink. And he was very insistent on ordering two meals, two drinks, two of everything that, you know, when he was only one person. So I assumed that he was waiting for something, because a lot of times it happens, somebody's waiting for someone. So that was okay. But I was kind of surprised that he was in such a rush to order the food, to get it to the table, to have everything before this other person arrived. And then as I was serving him and serving my other tables, I realized he was talking to himself. And that was when my heart sank. I realized that this man really thinks that there is somebody there with him, but that person doesn't really exist. So, you know, there was this back and forth, this communication between the two of us, and I was watching him the whole time, and I realized he's talking to a woman. And I gradually discovered that he told me that this woman was his wife, and this was their wedding anniversary, but then his wife had passed away, and it was a very emotional thing to be standing there watching this man having an anniversary lunch with his dead wife. And it really affected me. And this was before I had even considered writing a book about the ghosts of my past. And I literally, after Ed left, and he left me behind the bill, he wrote, he thanked me. I accepted him. I accepted that he believed that his wife was there, Heather, that, you know, they were having lunch together. And I have that bill. I have it on my fridge with a magnet. It's there. And I ran out of the restaurant after that, and I sat in my car, and I cried for a long time. And that was the very first time when I asked myself, who am I? This man is brave enough to grieve in such a public way. Whether he's crazy or not, that's not the question. He's grieving. I have never, ever grieved. I have just run away from everything. And I think that was one of those moments that really made me look back. And looking back was one of those steps that led to my writing Prison of Tehran, my first book.
And does looking back after suffering so much trauma, so much terror, is that something that they recommend? Is that something that helped you?
I've worked with psychologists and psychiatrists, and I have talked to them and all of that. A lot of them don't agree on everything, yeah. You know. So I think you have to do, it is great to talk to psychologists and psychiatrists. You have to find one that works for you. Not all of them can be helpful. So you have to find one that actually works for you. And then after that, you have to see every individual is different. Yes, there are generalizations, but every individual is unique. So you have to look at yourself. For I believe, in my case, and I believe in most cases, as long as you run away from what is troubling you, if it is something that has never been analyzed, that has never been opened up, that has never been discussed, when you have a secret in you, something that is eating you from within, you need to face it. If you don't, you will forever be its prisoner. This is the way I see it. Now, for some people, it is more difficult to face the past. But once you take that leap of faith, once you actually enter that realm and you look at it straight in the eye and you say, I'm not afraid of you, I can deal with you, there's no closure. Okay, so don't look for closure. Closure is a stupid word. It has to be taken out of the dictionary. Closure means closing. There's no closing to a part of who you are. That's ridiculous. Forget about that. Face it, deal with it, and you have to learn that even though there's a lot of grief in your life, a lot of pain and all of that, next to it, there is a possibility of happiness. I don't know if it's real, because I'm not exactly sure what happiness is, but at least it is something that resembles happiness. There is a lightness next to all the weight that you carry, and you can find it as long as you accept it.
You're Catholic, are you?
Yes, I am.
What role did your faith play in reclaiming your life?
I'm not quite sure. Life is such a complicated thing, and there are all sorts of issues and situations, and all of them come together, and it is very difficult to dissect it, to separate all these things. They become a fabric, and you cannot open it up. So I don't know exactly how big that role was, but definitely faith is something that plays a role in my life every single day, every single moment almost. There's a second that I would look around and I would think of God, or, you know, my relationship to him or whatever, you know, things like that. And in the prison, you know, when you're in solitary confinement for such a long time, day in and day out, that loneliness pushes you to the very edge of sanity, and a lot of people lose it. I think what kept my connection to, I guess, hope, to the thought that beyond all the darkness, there is some light, and all I need to do is survive to get there, was the thought that even though the world has forgotten me and doesn't care, God is here. And because I believe in Jesus, to me, I could relate to a man named Jesus who lived 2,000 years ago, because he was tortured, he was imprisoned, and then he was unjustly executed. So the fact that he had lived an experience similar to mine was almost like having him with me going through it. And it was almost like hearing him say, hey, you know, I went through the same thing. You can do it. So when I really hit the rock bottom, that would be the thought that would come to me that, you know, he did it, and so can I.
Do you miss Iran at all?
I miss it terribly.
Yeah.
You know, if Iran was an absolutely free country, you know, like somewhere where you could just go and come and travel and not be arrested, and, you know, just you know, a place like Canada, for example, if it were, you know, in this fictional scenario, I would probably divide my time between Canada and Iran. You know, I would probably, during winter, I would go to Tehran and just be with my friends, and I still have family there, with my friends and family, just walk the streets where I grew up as a child. I would love to show my children where I went to school. I want to go to that school. Last night I was speaking somewhere, and you know, I told them that, you know, one of my dreams is to have a flame that always burns placed in that school, because many kids from that school died in Iran's prisons, and the ones who survived were and are terribly damaged. I would like a flame to burn in Anshirvan Dadgar High School in downtown Tehran, a huge school built many years ago during the time of the father of the Shah. And I would like it to be a reminder to the people of Iran about this very dark period in our history, which is still actually continuing. So Iran is a place, you know, that I can never forget. A part of my heart would always be there. And I'm just hoping that before the end of life comes for me, I can return and I can do all these things that I have wished to do for such a long time.
Marina, it's been such a great pleasure to talk to you today. Congratulations on and continued good luck with this book.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. The website is marinanaymat.com. The book is called After Tehran, A Life Reclaimed. It's published by Viking. Its author, Marina Naymat, on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plante.